Welcome. Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theatre here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to this Perimeter's public lecture series presented by BMO Financial Group. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is a pleasure to welcome everyone here, both those of you here in the live studio audience and those of you watching online, whether on Perimeter's website or on one of our many science communication colleagues' websites around the globe. Now, just before we went live, we had the opportunity to present the 2016 Luc Santy Memorial Award for Student Achievement to Jocelyn Vanderveen. And Jocelyn's mother couldn't be here because she's recovering from shoulder surgery. So Jocelyn, if you look into that camera right there, you say hi, Mom, and the rest of us will congratulate her. The presentation this evening will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by question and answer session. And we are very fortunate tonight to have two colleagues of our presenter, Dr. Mogozia Pascula and Dr. David Wolf, behind our Twitter feed and our Facebook feed, ready to answer questions. So if you're in the online audience, use hashtag PILive, and you can engage in conversation throughout. And also, I'll be taking questions at the very end. Again, use hashtag PILive. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's very special guest speaker, Dr. Molly Choiquette. Dr. Choiquette holds the Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Tissue Engineering at the University of Toronto. She received her Bachelor of Science from MIT in Chemistry and her PhD from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in Polymer Science and Engineering. Dr. Choiquette is the recipient of many prestigious awards, including the L'Oréal UNESCO Women in Science Laureate for North America. In 2014, Professor Choiquette was given the University of Toronto's highest distinction, University Professor, a distinction held by less than 2% of the faculty. And she is the only person to be a fellow of Canada's three national academies, the Canadian Academy of Sciences, the Canadian Academy of Engineering, and the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences. She currently leads a laboratory of over 25 at the University of Toronto. The Choiquette Lab research program requires a cross-disciplinary approach where aspects of engineering, chemistry, and biology are applied to the fields of regenerative medicine, tissue engineering, and drug delivery. Tonight, Dr. Choiquette will discuss her research in regenerative medicine, and the opportunities it affords us. Please join me in welcoming to the stage with her talk, Engineering Change in Medicine, Dr. Molly Choiquette.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Good evening and welcome. Thank you so much for sharing this evening with me. I'm thrilled to be here and to share with you some of the research that we're doing. Now, when I was 14 years old, I had the opportunity to act in a play that my brother Richard Choiquette had directed and written and produced. And the play was called Landscape. My role as the 14-year-old was to look at all of the adults and ask this very important question, isn't it time for a change? And the whole premise was, if we keep doing the same things over and over again, it's highly unlikely that we're going to get change. Now, my brother Richard wasn't the first person to think about change. Of course, we have Mahatma Gandhi, be the change you wish to see in the world. We have Barack Obama, your voice can change the world. And of course, we had Justin Trudeau on the campaign trail fighting for real change. So I'm so excited to be here to tell you about our research. But I'm going to start by telling you about a social media campaign that I started with Mike McMillan, a feature film producer, and what we're doing there is changing the way we engage the public. So research to reality, the idea is to share what's going on across Canada in our research laboratories. So today's research, and why do people care? Because it's going to impact and change their future. Today's research, tomorrow's reality. We've partnered with top universities across Canada, the Ontario government, and I'm going to show you two short movies. I'm starting my lecture with one, It only lasts 1 minute, so don't close your eyes for too long. And then I'll end with another one. And so let's start the first one.
In a perfect world, it would never affect your friends, your family, your loved ones. In a perfect world, you'd never think about cancer. Thankfully, Canadian University researchers are making today's research tomorrow's reality, who are designing therapies that will attack the root of inoperable brain cancer, who are creating isotopes that not only see inside the disease, but deliver treatment specifically to affected cells. And working directly with patients to implement new stem cell therapies firsthand. Canadian researchers are making lives better. Come meet them.
I have to tell you, I've seen that video at least 1,000 times, and every time I'm so excited. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit. That's how we're trying to engage you, the public, in what we're doing in research across Canada. But it's fantastic to be here because I have the opportunity to tell you what we're doing in medicine, or how we're engineering change in medicine. And the fundamental idea is that Plan B really has to be different from Plan A. If we're really going to change the way we deliver treatments, we have to do things differently. So I'm going to tell you 3 stories this evening, and the first one relates to cancer. The second one relates to blindness, and the third one relates to stroke. I want to, though, emphasize that everything we're doing is in research. And so, while of course our goal and our passion is to make a difference in human health, this is the goal that we're striving towards, but we're not there yet. So let me start with what we're doing in cancer. It turns out that what we know, we the community know, about the cells in our body, most of what we know is based on, or a lot of what we know, is based on growing cells in hard plastic dishes, shown here. These are Petri dishes. And these are, this is a lovely image of what cells look like growing in those Petri dishes, those hard plastic dishes. But it turns out that actually we don't have any hard plastic in us, and we're three-dimensional. We're not growing on a surface. Our cells are not growing on a flat surface. And so we thought, you know, it turns out also that many cells from cancer tissues from that are biopsied from patients don't grow well in hard plastic dishes. So not only does this environment not represent the way cells grow in us, sometimes you can't even grow cells in the hard plastic dishes. So we were motivated to think about a way of growing cells in an environment that mimics the way those cells grow in us. And it turns out a lot of our tissues are soft, so we wanted to work with a soft material. And of course, we are 3D, so we wanted to work with a material that we could grow the cells in that type of environment, in a 3D environment. And you might say, well, why? Why do you need to do this? So I already told you that sometimes the cells don't grow in these hard dishes. But also, sometimes the information that we get from growing cells in the hard plastic dishes don't give us the information we need. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great if you could take a cell, a cancer cell, from a patient, grow them in an environment that mimics the way the cells grow in us, and then do drug screening, figure out which drug treatment strategy would be best for that individual. And so that's the drive versus actually, treating that individual with a series of drugs to find out the best treatment strategy. So that's been a big motivation for our research. So we started to work with hydrogels. Hydrogels are water-swollen materials, so Jell-O. We're not working with Jell-O. But Jell-O, I love you guys, you're laughing at my jokes, it's awesome. Jell-O is a water-swollen material. So we wanted to work with a material that's already present natively in the cancer tissue. And it turns out there's a material called hyaluronan or hyaluronic acid. Now, I imagine that many of you have heard of hyaluronan or hyaluronic acid because it's in lots of creams. We can get it injected in us to get rid of some of our wrinkles. It's being injected into knees for osteoarthritis. So that's a material that's also actually highly expressed in breast cancer tissue and in other cancer tissues throughout the body. So we thought, let's work with hyaluronan. That already mimics the environment in which cells grow in us, in cancer cells. But unlike Jell-O, we couldn't simply put it in the refrigerator to have it form a gel. What we had to do is design chemical ways to cross-link the hyaluronan or the hyaluronic acid. And that's part of the innovation that we've achieved in the lab. So the driving force then is if we're saying that we're going to create an environment that mimics the way cells grow in us, then the first thing we have to do is figure out how do the cells grow in us. So we look at what's called the extracellular matrix. That's just the material around the cell. And we can look at its mechanical properties, its chemical properties, and its physical properties, topology or architecture. And then, because we're engineers, we can engineer a matrix, an environment in which to grow the cells based on hyaluronan, and PEG is just polyethylene glycol, and we can control the mechanical properties of our material to match those. We can control the chemical properties of the material to match those. And we can control the architectural to match those. And this last one, we've used a process called cryogelation, which just means cryo is freezing, right? So we're using temperatures to create really interesting architectures in our gels. So one of the PhD students in the lab, Stephanie Fisher, what she's been doing is she's really interested in understanding the role of that extracellular environment in causing cell migration. So this is something that we see in metastasis. And so in this very simple model, what Stephanie can do is she can engineer the material by controlling what's called cross-link density. So how these chains are connected together and how many links we have, that controls our mechanical properties. We can use cross-links, so these little blue rectangles represent ways of linking all these chains together. We can use cross-links where the cells can actively degrade it, so they can remodel their own environment. Alternatively, we can incorporate some of those biochemical cues, which are just shown here with the stars, and those will enhance the way the cells interact with the environment. So all this to say is that we have great control in creating an environment in creating an environment that mimics the way the cells grow natively. And so I'll just share a couple of images with you. This is actually one of those cryogels. So you can see all those red lines, those sort of wispy red lines, are meant to represent, or they do represent the architecture of this hydrogel. So it's got some really interesting architecture. So it's not just transparent, the kind of the way the gel is. And what you can see here are these are spheroids, these are breast cancer cells that have self-organized in a way similarly to the way they would be natively. And you can see it's 3D by this 3D rendering. And I'll show you another image. So again, over on this side, you see a number of these different breast cancer spheroids. And in this rendering, you just get a sense of that it's really 3D. Okay, so now we're at a really exciting point in our research. I have to tell you that as simple as this may look, it took us about close to a decade to really design an appropriate system. And now we're at this stage where we can start taking cancer cells and we can start screening them, either from patients or even in drug screening. There's a big challenge in drug screening, and I'm sure you've all heard how many times we've cured cancer in mice, right? So there's a big challenge in drug screening when you screen a number of different drugs, and then you got a hit, and then you test it, and then it fails, right? And that happens a lot. So we're really excited that this system is because it mimics better how the cells grow natively, we can now use that for drug screening applications, and then we can also use it in this application of personalized medicine to try and figure out the appropriate strategies, and then also look into figuring out new strategies. So that was story number one, all about breast cancer. Let me tell you about, like, what is regenerative medicine and what are we trying to do in it? So we're working on two different projects here, and the first one I'm going to tell you about relates to blindness, and then I'm going to tell you a story that relates to stroke. In our regenerative medicine research, what we're looking at is cell transplantation. So that means injecting cells into either the back of the eye, into the brain, or the spinal cord. And that's what you see here. So these are just cross sections. In applications of stroke, we're injecting cells into the brain. For spinal cord injury, we're injecting cells into the injured spinal cord. And in applications of blindness, we're injecting cells to the back of the eye, to the retina. So that's one strategy to try and enhance regeneration by replacing the actual cells that are lost after a devastating injury or disease. So if we talk a little bit about blindness now, our research is really focused on a couple of different diseases. One, age-related macular degeneration. What occurs in age-related macular degeneration is it's a degenerative disease, and over time, you lose your central vision. Retinitis pigmentosa is a disease that you're born with, and over time, you lose your peripheral vision. And with diabetic retinopathy, you end up with a dappled vision. Now, what's fantastic for patients is that we have drugs that will slow the progression of this disease. But what's not fantastic is that this disease will continue to progress, even with those drugs. And so what are we trying to do with regenerative medicine? We're trying to stop the disease and actually reverse it. That's the idea of actually restoring people's vision after they've lost it, or maybe before they've completely lost it. So let me just orient you a little bit to where the retina is. Light comes into the eye and hits the back of the eye, and this is our retina. And the retina has 7 layers of cells, so much more complicated than you may have thought. And the 2 cell types that have intimate interaction and are really important for vision, of course, they're all important for vision, but the ones that are most important are these photoreceptor cells. These look like rods and cones. And these cells at the very back, these sort of cuboidal-looking cells, these are the retinal pigment epithelial cells. So it turns out in those diseases that I just mentioned, age-related macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, it's these 2 cell types that die at the back of the eye. So we are really interested then in replacing those exact cells that die with degeneration that leads to blindness. Now, my collaborator, Derek Vanderkooy, discovered that we all have retinal stem cells in our eyes. So he discovered in the mouse, and he discovered in the human eye. So if you think about your eye, and you think about the black rim that surrounds your iris, right? Everybody got that? And at the very edge of that is what's called the ciliary body. And these are the retinal stem and progenitor cells, so the retinal stem cells. And it turns out, so what is a stem cell? A stem cell has the capacity to become itself. It's called self-renewal. And it has the capacity to become all the other cell types in that tissue, if it's a mature stem cell. So this retinal stem cell has the capacity to become all of these different cells in the retina. And through collaboration with Derek Vanderkooy, we supervised Brian Balios, who's now a medical doctor, when he was doing his PhD. Now, if you look closely at this picture, you'll see that Brian is looking down a microscope. And what is looking back up at him? A mouse. So we've just published this paper last year, and it received a lot of press. And you'll see why in a couple minutes. So what's really cool is the mouse was not Photoshopped into that. I like to tell people it took a really long time to get that photo. But it took a lot longer to do the research. So what do we want to do? We want to transplant the cells right where they're lost, and we want to transplant the cells in an environment that will promote their survival and integration. So by analogy, think about a large cable of wires that you've now severed. Okay, so now you have two ends. You no longer have electrical conductivity. If you just threw in a bunch of wires, you would not restore electrical conductivity, right? Each wire would have to be soldered into place in order to restore that. Well, the same is true in the nervous system. If we just throw in a bunch of cells and they don't integrate into the neural circuitry, they're not going to restore vision. And in fact, they're not going to survive. So we have two challenges. One, we need the cells to survive. And once they've survived, we need them to integrate. So we've been looking at both of those issues and trying to come up with a strategy that will promote greater cell survival and greater cell integration. So here's just a real simple image. Our cells are green. And I have to tell you that most of the world, when they inject cells, they inject them with a salt solution into the body. And so that's saline. And they usually aggregate, so they cluster together, and they don't usually survive very long. So in the biomaterial that we invented in our lab, we realized that when we injected the cells, we got a lovely distribution of cells across what's called the Bruch's membrane. And this in itself, just that lovely distribution, enhanced survival. And it turned out the material that we were using had a biological effect that also promoted greater survival. But survival isn't enough, right? Just as I said, after a short period of time, the cells will perish if they don't integrate. So just to give you another, show you a little bit more about the retina, we have, if you can see, there's a little faint orange line called the outer limiting membrane. And it's comprised of what are called the Müller glial end feet. Okay, so you have all of these cells projecting these end feet that create a membrane that limits integration into what's called the outer nuclear layer. Now we're injecting our cells right around here, right above the retinal pigment epithelial layer. So it was shown a number of years ago that you could add a small molecule, alpha amino adipic acid, and it would transiently cause those Müller end feet to retract. Okay, so it's actually a transient gliotoxin. And then over time, they would reform. So what we thought, okay, if we're injecting our cells here and we need them to migrate up there, we need to get rid of that membrane. And so that's our pro-integration factor that we delivered prior to cell transplantation. Now here what you're seeing are the rod photoreceptors that we differentiated from the retinal stem cells. And we injected them into what's called the subretinal space. We don't really have a subretinal space. The subretinal space, though, would be right between the RPE and the photoreceptor layer. So we just inject a small amount there, and our cells are in green. And what you can see is that a number of them are coming into that outer nuclear layer. So we were so excited when we saw this image. Right? Because we had achieved success, at least from a tissue perspective. And I have to tell you that one of our collaborators, Valerie Wallace, and a couple other people internationally who've seen some exciting results, have realized that we're not sure what's actually happening here now. This is the great thing about science. You get a great result, and then you go, okay, wait, maybe we should re-examine that. But I'm still going to show you some good results. So we're not sure, actually, and this is very hot off the press, if the cells are actually integrating or they're just transferring genetic information to the cells that are already there. So in order to transfer that information, they do have to penetrate and get into that tissue. So it's not that the cells aren't there. We're just not sure of the mechanism, the exact way this is happening right now. But let me show you some of the data that we got in terms of a functional assay. So in this study, what Brian Balios did is he shone a very bright light at the eyes of the mouse. Now, one eye, the left eye, was not treated. It was just given the vehicle control. Okay, so that's just our hydrogel and that pro-integration factor. The right eye was given those two, that delivery vehicle, that hydrogel, and our rod photoreceptors. And we were looking for a pupillary response. So you know that if you go from a dark room to a very bright room, so it's a bright sunny day, there's a beach. Okay, we don't really need the beach, but it's a bright sunny day, and your pupil is going to get smaller, right? Because it doesn't need to be as big because there's more light available. So that's similar to what we did in this study. We shone a very bright light at the eyes, and we looked at the dilated area. So here it's 100% dilated. This is a genetic model of blindness. These animals have no pupillary response, as you can see from the left eye. But the eye that's treated, as we increase the brightness of that light, we're getting to that dilated area is shrinking to about 85% of what it was. So that's really exciting because it does tell us that the cells have integrated and are resulting in some functional response. But at the same time, we also realize that if you take a normal mouse, so a wild-type mouse, and shine the same brightness of light on that mouse's eye, the dilated area goes down to about 20%. Okay, so what this tells us is that we are achieving success, but we have a lot further to go to really overcome this. So what are we doing? We're doing a lot of things, but one of the things that we're doing from an engineering perspective is thinking, well, how can we get more of those cells to survive? I have to tell you, we went from about 4% survival using the traditional methods to 8% survival. That's awesome. We doubled the number of cells that were surviving. But if you think about it, 90% of the cells are still dying. So clearly there's further for us to go. We can get more cells surviving. And how are we doing that? We're thinking about that environment in which we're delivering the cells. How can we make it, how can we incorporate pro-survival factors, perhaps proteins, growth factors, peptides into that milieu so we get more cells surviving and more cells integrating? This is a very active area of research that we're pursuing. The last story that I'll tell you relates to stroke. Now, when I went to high school, I learned that we were born with a certain number of nerve cells in our brains. Some of you may have learned that as well. Well, in the early 1990s, Brent Reynolds and Sam Weiss discovered that we actually had stem cells in our brains, the neural stem cells. And those neural stem cells have the capacity to become all the cells in our brain, the nerve cells, the astrocytes, oligodendrocytes. So there was a paradigm shift because now our brains do have the capacity to repair. And it turns out that when a person gets a stroke, their neural stem cells are stimulated, but not enough to promote functional repair. And it turns out, also, this is a really big problem. There's been over 1,000 failed clinical trials in stroke. Okay, so a really big problem, and we're really excited to be working on coming up with very different strategies to try and promote repair. Now, the holy grail of regenerative medicine is trying to get those stem cells that are already resident in us to regenerate that lost tissue. And that's exactly what we're doing. So one of my colleagues, Cindy Morsehead, had discovered that if she delivered two factors sequentially to the brain, She used a pump and catheter, so basically pushed tube. This is not in a human, and this is in a model of disease, but pushed a catheter through the brain into what's called the ventricles. Now, it turns out the stem cells in the brain line the ventricles in our brain. Then she could stimulate those stem cells to promote tissue and functional repair. So we were really excited to work with Professor Morsed, but wondered if we could do something less invasive. So that's the story that I'm going to tell you about. First of all, we know stroke is a big problem. We only have rehabilitation, really, to help stroke patients. There is one drug, tissue plasminogen activator, which is approved. And if you get to the hospital within a short period of time, it really is very helpful. But other than that, there's really, other than rehabilitation, there's not much that we can provide. Now, most strokes are called ischemic strokes, but we also have hemorrhagic strokes. That is where a blood vessel would burst in the brain. Regardless, what happens is you lose, even for a short period of time, you lose oxygen and nutrients in the brain. This leads to cell death, tissue damage, and behavioral deficit. So what the Morsed lab had designed was akin to this strategy. I realize that I'm showing you a picture of a human or an image of what would be a human brain. So this is not done in a human brain, but imagine you had a reservoir here and you had a catheter going down into the ventricle of the brain. Highly invasive, right? You're sticking a tube into someone's brain. So we thought, could we do something that achieved the same results? Could we promote tissue and functional repair, but in a less invasive strategy? And so we designed a hydrogel, or I think of it as a drug-infused Band-Aid, that we can put directly onto the brain. Or think of it as a little patch, which is shown here. And the idea is that the molecules, the proteins in here, will diffuse directly into the brain and stimulate those same stem cells. So you might be saying to yourself right now, really, why can't you just take a pill? Or why can't you just deliver it intravenously, right? Most of the drugs we take, we take them that way. Well, in fact, all of the drugs we take, we either take them orally or intravenously. Why do we have to do something so complicated and put a little Band-Aid on the brain or a patch on the brain? And the reason is that the blood vessels in the brain, the endothelial cells that make up the blood vessels in our brain form these tight junctions, and it results in what's called the blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier is fantastic. It protects us from toxins that we might ingest every day. But when we're trying to get drugs to the brain or the spinal cord, the blood-brain barrier is a real impediment. So there's lots of great research going on where people are trying to sort of open up that barrier so drugs can get through. But we had a very different approach. Instead of trying to like crash through that barrier, we're just trying to go around it. Because when we take a drug orally, when we take it intravenously, we're taking advantage of the vascular system to deliver it throughout our body. And we're taking advantage of the vascular system to deliver it to our tissues. Okay, so what we're doing here is just going around that barrier and delivering it directly to the tissue. So that's the idea. So in this project, what we did is we invented a new material called hyaluronan and methyl cellulose. So I already talked to you a little bit about hyaluronan. You can tell this is a material that we seem to like in our lab. I have to tell you, it was completely coincidental. It's a really cool engineering material. And I'm going to show you a little video and show you why it's so cool. But this material, hyaluronan, is what we call shear thinning. You apply a little bit of pressure and it flows. This material, methyl cellulose, is what's called inverse thermal gelling. Most things you heat up and they go into solution, right? If you're trying to get sugar to dissolve in water, if you heat it up, it's going to go into solution much faster. Methyl cellulose, though, does the opposite. When you heat it up, it actually forms a gel. But it takes too long to form a gel. It takes like 20 minutes. We wanted something to form a gel really quickly. So it turns out when you mix it with hyaluronan, it forms a gel much faster. But then you end up with a gel in your syringe. So how are you going to push a gel? Like, imagine you had Jell-O in a syringe and you had to push it through a tiny needle. It wouldn't work. The needle would come off or something bad would happen. But because it's sheer thinning, you apply a little pressure and it flows. So I'll show you this little video of our hyaluron and methyl cellulose. Now you're going to see that it's blue. We've colored it blue just so that you can see it. It's actually transparent. And really, I've got this entire little video just to show you the size of the needle. And the other cool thing is that as soon as it comes out of the needle, so you're going to see it come out of the needle now, as soon as it comes out of the needle, it's going to form this blue blob, which just means it's forming a gel as soon as the pressure's released. So that's why it's kind of a cool engineering material. Now, the size of the blue blob doesn't mean anything. And this penny is here just to give you a reference point for the size of the needle. I have to tell you, I love showing this video in the U.S. because in Canada, we're so smart, we don't have the penny anymore. Now, I just realized this is going globally, so I hope people still like me. No, I tell that joke to my friends in the U.S. too. Anyway, okay, so now we have this material that can serve as that reservoir. But we had to deliver two protein molecules. One is called epidermal growth factor, and the other is erythropoietin. So EGF and EPO. And why did we have to deliver these two factors? It's because our collaborator, Cindy Morsehead, had demonstrated that if you deliver EGF first for 7 days, and then erythropoietin for 7 days, that, and it had to be sequential, that was the situation under which she saw tissue and functional repair in a model of stroke. But we didn't want to just fill up our reservoir with one factor, come back a week later and fill it up again with another factor. We thought, hey, we're engineers, we can design a system to make this work. So this is work that was done by Yanfei Wang in the lab. And what she did is she put the EGF in a little capsule. So imagine like a soccer ball, right? So a little capsule, but now the capsule is smaller than a human hair. So it's a nano capsule or a nano bead, a nanosphere. And we wanted this one to be released first. So what did she do with the erythropoietin? She also put it in a little nanosphere. So she has her protein in the nanosphere, and then she puts another coating around it. So kind of imagine like an M&M, right? So that's, you got your coating on the outside before you can get to, and that has to dissolve before you, unless you chew, but that would be cheating, before you can get to the one on the inside. But so what this did then is, we wanted to get the EGF released first, and this is the data that we see. It's first released for 7 days, and then you can see with this system, that second coating delayed the release, and it doesn't come out, you know, until about somewhere between 4 and 7 days. So this is what we saw in the lab, and this is what we saw in the tissue, in the brain tissue, where we see first, you know, our epidermal growth factor coming out, and then our erythropoietin. So we had the system now to ask the question, to do that direct comparison. Will this give us the same tissue benefit that we saw with the more invasive strategy? So here we have our drug delivery scaffold or drug delivery vehicle, where, you know, there's a stroke at day zero. 4 days later, we implant our hydrogel that will deliver these two factors, EGF for 7 days, followed by erythropoietin, and did a direct head-to-head comparison to the more traditional way where you have a pump and you have that catheter going into the brain, and this is representing those ventricles. Remember, the stem cells line the ventricles. So the great thing with this strategy is you know those proteins are getting to those stem cells because you're injecting it right into the area where they're located. Here, we had to make sure that they would actually diffuse into the brain, but I just showed you the data that said they would. So what we did, there's a lot of data on this slide, and I don't want to overwhelm you with this, but I want you to focus on the blue bars and the red bars. So what we saw is we looked for the nerve tissue that had regrown in this model of stroke. And you see we get the same amount of nerve tissue that's grown, so regenerated nerve tissue, when we deliver it with our patch versus delivering it with a more invasive pump system. And we've reduced cell death. So here, if we look at the blue bar and the red bar, we looked at cell death. So tunnel is a stain for cell death. And we have much less cell death when we do the patch versus doing the pump catheter. So if you're listening, you're saying, obviously. Obviously you have less cell death. You didn't stick a tube through the brain, right? But the really amazing thing about this data is, the catheter was on this side and we were looking on the other side of the brain. So this wasn't damage associated directly with pushing a tube through the brain. And so this data now is, again, a very active area of research. We're looking at different molecules to stimulate those stem cells and promote tissue and functional repair. So it's a very exciting time for us in research. So I've had the opportunity then to tell you three stories, one related to cancer and how we're trying to grow cells in an environment in the lab that will allow us to provide better personalized treatments for patients and also better ways of screening drugs. I told you about our stem cell transplantation strategies that we hope to lead to cures for blindness. And then I told you about our strategies in stroke, where we want to take advantage of the stem cells that are already resident in us to promote tissue and functional repair. These ways of tackling these big, big problems in medicine are very different than what's been done traditionally for the past several decades. So it's a very exciting time. There are clinical trials that are going on in the field of regenerative medicine, and so it's a very exciting time to be in the field and proposing new ideas. If you think about all the tissues and organs in your body, I can tell you that there is somebody around the world that is focused on promoting tissue repair there, whether it's in academic institutions or in companies. There is a tremendous amount of research going on to try and make a difference in human health with this idea of regenerative medicine. But it doesn't happen alone. It really requires all of us to come together to do something different. Of course, we have the patients that are willing to try new things. We have, the scientists, the universities, educators, business community willing to fund. We need the venture capital community to come in and fund these things. Government, of course, plays a huge role in creating the regulatory environment to make sure everything is safe. And also, they fund a lot of our research. So I wanted to just acknowledge all the people really in my scientific life, but also my personal life that have made a difference to me. And I start with my family, my mom and dad, who passed away a number of years ago now. We like to celebrate in our family. So this is when I was first promoted to professor. My husband, Kevin Bardis, and our two sons. I love this picture. They hate it because they're teenagers, and so teenagers don't like pictures of themselves when they were cute and little. Actually, we were in Paris, and you might be able to see my mom there, but what was so great about, there were so many great things about winning the L'Oréal UNESCO Award, but one of the things that was super fun is we were walking down the street, and they had, at a bus stop, they had this enormous picture that was rotating, and so there I was, La science a besoin des femmes, and so we were walking by and we were like, hey, so then we had to take our picture with it, so that was fun. This is my brother Richard and my brother Brian, who are great big brothers to me, and Brian's also a professor at UC San Francisco, and then Michael Sefton and Mitch Winnick are really strong and great mentors for me at the University of Toronto. I want to just acknowledge all the former graduate students and postdoctoral fellows I've had the privilege of supervising. This is my lab today, and these are all the people that have done just amazing work that I've had the privilege to present to you and share with you. And then these are all of our collaborators. So, we love to collaborate and, working in this field, tackling big problems in medicine with innovative strategies in engineering can't be done alone. And so we love working and collaborating with people in all sorts of complementary disciplines so that we can ultimately one day make a real difference. So I'm going to close with one last video from Research to Reality, and then I'd be happy to answer your questions.
It's deeply human to explore how things work, to understand why things happen. In the 21st century, quantum physics sits at the core of how we communicate and approach unanswerable questions. Canadian University researchers are using light to store and manipulate information. Brilliant minds in the field are working with the Canadian Space Agency to create new ways of sending quantum information around the world to secure online transactions and ensure information safety. They're using quantum computers to solve math problems that were too large for traditional computers. It's a new technology that promises to revolutionize the way we live today and tomorrow. Canadian researchers are out there exploring. Come meet them.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions. So there's a microphone here for those in studio, and I'll start with the first question as the lines form. Perimeter premised on cross-disciplinary collaboration, and you mentioned it right there at the end. Can you tell us a little bit more about what led you to the very diverse cross-discipline collaboration that you've set up in your lab, and what strategic advantages it brings?
Okay, so the strategic advantage. So first of all, we can't do it alone. So we have to collaborate. And it turns out that I love to collaborate. And why do I love to collaborate? Because we get to learn so much more. You know, and we get to do so many more things. You know, if I was working alone, I could just probably work in one area. And I'm just love the opportunity to work in so many areas. And then I get to work with brilliant people. So they enrich our lives, really, in so many ways. But in the science way, they make sure, like when I'm collaborating with a fundamental stem cell biologist, they're going to make sure that we're answering questions at the cutting edge in stem cell biology, you know, and then I can make sure that we're answering the cutting edge questions in material science so that we can bring those two fields together and do something that other people wouldn't, you know, have the opportunity to do.
Thank you. Here we have a question.
Hi, I had a question about your pupillary response.
Yes.
So I understand you're trying to figure out if the animals can see or there is some response. So I wondered, is the pupillary response a reaction? And because I know eyesight, if you have someone who's born blind, they'll never see if you don't allow them to see in the first couple of years because their cortical organization doesn't occur.
Right.
So when you're looking at your pupillary response of, you know, a constriction or a dilation, how do you know that that's actually helping the optic nerve, or it must be like a feedback loop? So that doesn't integrate into the brain or anything any further, does it?
Yes, so that's a really fantastic question. So thank you very much for asking it. This is a genetic knockout model of blindness. And in this model, it's a mouse model of blindness. The mouse actually has all of the neural circuitry. So they actually have the photoreceptors and the RPE, and like as I was talking about in the presentation. So they have that neural circuitry. So it's a little bit different than the human condition. So it's a really good question. And so one of the things that we're looking at currently in our lab is we're looking at co-delivery of multiple cell types. So because we know if we just replace the photoreceptors, if the RPE aren't there, then the photoreceptors won't survive, and kind of vice versa. So we're looking at that, and we're also looking at a different disease model, still where they had that circuitry, but then were wiping out those cells. So different from the genetic model that I presented, because those cells still exist. So with this new model of blindness, we can also overcome a challenge that I mentioned that the community internationally is facing, which is, are the cells actually integrating, or are you just getting genetic transfer of information? But because we wipe out those cells, there'd be no cells to transfer that information to. So, so thank you for that question. I think this, what we're looking at is the degeneration of these cells over time. And so that neural circuitry would be there. But you're right, if you don't use it, it won't be there.
And one more question. You've mimicked, you're attempting to mimic the actual tissue, but you talked about the delivery system and you were talking about the blood-brain barrier. In the first hydrogels that you developed, how do you mimic the delivery system that, say, chemotherapy or something like that? How do you, because you're trying to figure out how to attack the cancer cells and what's going to be useful, how do you mimic the body's delivery to the cells, to the hydrogel? Like the drugs.
Okay. Oh, okay. So around the cancer problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you only get to ask two questions because they're both so brilliant. No, I'm just joking. you don't have to go away. You can ask the third. So the question is really a fundamental challenge that we the community face in cancer, which is, first of all, we have these really potent chemotherapeutics, but they have these awful side effects. And then the other big challenge we face is how do those drugs penetrate into the tumor? And I think, well, you've gone away now, and I can't see because the bright lights, which means I'm standing in the right place. There's a big challenge of getting drugs to penetrate into tumors. And I think the question was really, so let's say you can mimic the environment in which these cells grow, can you actually mimic how drugs will diffuse into those tumors? And we've been collaborating with Eugenia Kumacheva, another professor in chemistry at U of T, and she's developed some microfluidics platforms. And what this allows us to do is use flow and at least start to address that question of penetration into these tumors. With, you know, trying to address another fantastic problem.
Let's go to an online question. The question is, what advice would you give to a young woman interested in a career in your field?
Right, so first of all, we need men and women to come into this field because as I've showed you, we're facing really big problems. These are not easy solutions to find. If they were, we would have solved them. So what I would love to have is more men, more women coming into the field of science and engineering to try and solve really big problems. And to young women in general, I would say stick with it. We see a lot of women drop out for various reasons. I have an amazing career. I love my job. There's a lot of flexibility. I have a family. I have a great husband, a great support system, and you know, you can have a career, you can have a family, and this is a wonderful one. And there's also what I love so much about working in this field is I get to be creative. You know, I get to go, I wonder if. You know, and as long as I can convince somebody to fund that, then, okay, so that's a big if. You know, it just gives us the opportunity to create and innovate. And so it's wonderfully exciting. So, you know, I welcome as many of you as possible.
Thank you. Let's take one more question from in studio.
Hello. Thank you for your talk. It was really exciting to hear about all those developments that you're making. And my question had to do with neural connectivity. So you were talking about the growth factors that you guys put in to promote connectivity to, I guess, old or new neurons. So I'm wondering whether or not you think that there would be vision therapy or some sort of behavioral or learning that would have to go on post this growth factor from being injected, because one of the basic principles of the nervous system is that neurons that fire together wire together. So we'd want to make sure that those connections are useful so that we can learn and react to our environment.
Yeah, so another fantastic question. Thank you for asking that. So one of the things we're always worried about, as you kind of suggested, is that, you know, what happens if you get the wrong connections made? Or you get, connections that are just firing and causing actually more problems than actually helping. So one of the things we're doing is we're collaborating with Dale Corbett's lab at the University of Ottawa, and his lab looks at environment enrichment or rehabilitation in animal models of disease. So you're absolutely right. It's a very, we're just at the point now where we've got some really exciting results in terms of, let's call it chemical stimulation or protein stimulation of the stem cells, and we are seeing them regenerate. But we want to take advantage of what's called plasticity in the brain. So we know that the brain, it's called plastic, and I'm not really sure why, except that, you know, think about being able to mold it and trying to get new connections formed. And so hopefully by working, bringing that another field into this area of rehabilitation combined with, you know, stimulation of the stem cells, that will get everything, as you said, you know, wired together and firing together appropriately. But we do have to, you know, we will have to relearn how to do things functionally.
So this might be a good opportunity for occupational therapists or other therapists to get sort of involved in sort of creating the right macro environment for these micro environmental changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Molly Choquette.